You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the professional golf world is facing some structural and moral dilemmas as PGA players seek bigger payouts from a Saudi-backed tournament. A Wisconsin golf writer tells us what's been going on in the sport. Now, almost half of the cases decided by the state Supreme Court so far this term have split 4-3. It's according to new data from Marquette University. The research says justices are ruling 4-3 more often this term than at any point in more than seven decades. Alan Ball analyzed that data for ScoutStats.com. That's a blog that crunches numbers about cases and decisions from the Wisconsin Supreme Court. He's a professor of history at Marquette University. Alan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
How does this 4-3 decision split compare with years past?
Well, it's much higher, as you said. In fact, as a result of the most recent decision that was filed, it's now exactly half of all the decisions this term. There were 30 decisions filed this term, and 15 of them have been 4-3, which is much higher than any of the previous years. The next highest year was the previous year, 2021, for 37%, and that was a result of some of the factors I imagine that we'll be talking about today. The other surprising thing was that it, with a court that's usually regarded as a conservative court, that the liberal justices have been in the majority of these 4-3 decisions much more often than the justices who are regarded as the most conservative, justices Rogan, Sack, and Ziegler, and Rebecca Bradley. Two very big surprises.
Before we dig into the swing vote on these, what is it about these narrow decisions? Why are they so common this last couple of years?
Well, I'd say that it's because you have two groups of three justices each, the three liberals, Ann Walsh Bradley, Dalit, and Karofsky on the one hand, and Rogan, Sack, Ziegler, and Rebecca Bradley on the other, that almost always vote together in these decisions. So you've got automatically or almost automatically three on one side and three on the other side, and meaning that there, it's going to be a 4-3 decision, and the crucial player as a result is Justice Hagedorn, who has been in the majority almost always in these 13 out of 15 of the 4-3 decisions. He's been in the majority, and so in effect, you're not going to win unless you get Hagedorn's vote. And as I said, one of the most surprising things is that he has sided more often with the liberals this time, this term, so far anyway, than he has with the conservatives.
And surprising because he was a candidate. We have, these are nonpartisan offices. You don't run with an R or D, but all the candidates are backed by Republicans or Democrats. He had support from Republicans in his campaign.
Yes, well, he was Governor Walker's legal counsel, so I would never have predicted this when he was running for the Supreme Court.
Now, something struck me looking at your charts on this. We've got this jump in 4-3 rulings. At the other end, there's a lot of unanimous rulings. There's just not a lot of ground between those. So what, are a bunch of the issues, I guess, gimmies? No matter where you're coming from on the court, you're going to join a unanimous decision on it?
Well, the percentage of unanimous decisions is currently right now is 40%, which isn't unusual. There have been recent years where it's been at least 40, if not higher. It's relatively high, but not unusual. The biggest change has been in that there are very, very few 6-1 and 5-2 decisions, far fewer than in any of the other years that I've looked at. And that reflects the fact that, as I mentioned, that you have three justices on the liberal side and three on the conservative side that almost always vote together. If it's a gimme, as you say, then they're all going to vote together. But it's much, much rarer that you only have one or two in the minority.
We've got a state Supreme Court election race next year, an open seat. One of the conservative justices stepping down is the current plan anyway. This narrow split, I imagine, is going to put a lot of focus on this election.
Oh, yes. This will be a tremendously consequential election, depending on what happens, of course. If, say, Justice Rogan's Act is replaced with someone who's regarded as a liberal, then we would have on the court something that we've never had before in all of the decades that I've been serving, and that is that you would have four liberals. And that, of course, could result in very different decisions on provocative cases, say gerrymandering or other things, than we've had in the past. If Justice Rogan's Act is replaced with someone who's a conservative, then we'd have pretty much what we have right now, where Justice Hagedorn would be the crucial vote. If Justice Rogan's Act is replaced with a liberal, however, Justice Hagedorn's role would become much less significant because the liberals could win without him. They would have Ann Walsh Bradley, Dalit, Kurilsky and whoever the new liberal was. And so Justice Hagedorn would be in a similar position to what he was in back in 2019-20 when Justice Kelly was still on the court, and the conservatives could win without Hagedorn. And so he was much less often crucial and much less often in the 4-3 majorities. Back then, the conservatives didn't need him in 2019-20 with Kelly. And if Roggenzack is replaced with a liberal, then now the liberals wouldn't need him.
This is we've done the number crunching here. Can you remind people why it's important to watch these kind of trends in the state Supreme Court and what kind of things are at stake in the state?
Well, it's extremely important because so many very provocative issues come before the court. Say, for instance, in the recent year, measures pertaining to how COVID should be dealt with or should not be dealt with, and especially challenges to the election, that there have been a large number of original action petitions filed where some actor, some group is asking the court to take a case immediately and not let it go through the lower courts. Generally challenging the election, and the court can make crucial decisions that affect everybody's life, whether, say, we accept the election as valid. For instance, last year there were an unprecedentedly large number of original action petitions filed challenging the election, and the court generally rejected them. And here, too, in the 8 cases where we know how the justices voted. We only know if they file a dissent or a concurrence or something, then we know how they voted. In the 8 cases where we know how they voted, the conservative justices wanted to accept cases that challenged the election, much along the lines, say, that former Justice Gableman is trying to do now, and Hagedorn sided with the liberals in refusing to take those cases. If, say, Dan Kelly had not lost to Kurilsky and had still been on the court, then we might have had 4 justices agreeing to take these challenges to the elections. And of course, the landscape politically could have been quite different. So yes, there's tremendous importance resting on the outcome of these Supreme Court elections.
Alan, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Alan Ball, professor of history at Marquette University, with us today to talk about his new data showing a record percentage of 4-3 rulings from Wisconsin's Supreme Court so far in the court's current term. He wrote about those numbers on his blog, SCOW Stats. That's SCOWstats.com. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Carl Christensen brings us a story about lessons learned on a family camping trip.
Taking the kids camping usually sounds like a great idea, until it's not. Author B.J. Hollers brings us a story about the trials and triumphs of the family camping trip.
It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. With those famous words, Charles Dickens opened his classic novel, which, if you read no further, might very well be a book about camping. Ah, camping, the foolhardiest of summer traditions. The chance to dust off the tent, unfurl the sleeping bags, and pretend that you enjoy the outdoors. And all the better if you actually do. And we did, at least for a little while, as my children and I pulled into our campsite at Coon Fork Campground 30 miles east of Eau Claire. Standing at the edge of our site, we peered out at the glistening 62-acre lake, while overhead the birds welcomed us with song. My 8-year-old son shimmied beneath my left arm, my 6-year-old daughter took refuge beneath my right. Together, we all inhaled a gallon-sized breath of cool Wisconsin air. It was the best of times, indeed. Right up until the storm struck a few hours later, sending us speeding back to the comforts of our home. Warm beds never felt so good. Returning to our site the following morning, I was relieved to find that the weather gods had taken pity on us. Our tent had not become a houseboat as I'd feared, merely a waterbed. No matter, it was nothing 10 absorbent towels couldn't fix. Our return to Coon Fork the morning following the storm came with an added challenge. Our 9-month-old baby, who was destined to enjoy her first day of camping while my wife went off to work. Perhaps enjoy is too strong a word. Maybe endure is more accurate. Which she did, suffering little more than a forehead scrape after a topple from the cooler while Daddy extinguished an unplanned cook stove fire that had scorched our lunch. Best of times, indeed. When my wife and the puppy pulled into our campsite at day's end, she witnessed a scene pulled not from the pages of Dickens, but William Golding's Lord of the Flies. We were scraped, sunburned, hungry, tired, and trapped in a soggy tent. "How's it going?" she asked. The baby wailed. Sometime after midnight, I woke to the sound of my wife searching frantically in the dark for a diaper. We searched by cell phone glow as the baby's discomfort grew. "I think one's in the van," my wife whispered. Untangling myself from my sleeping bag, I high-stepped over the snoozing puppy, tripped on the lip of the tent, had a run-in with some overly confident raccoons, and at last retrieved the diaper as directed. Then I reversed course, passed those raccoons over the tent lip and atop the snoozing puppy. Proudly, I handed the diaper to my wife. "And the wipes?" she asked. I sighed. After that second trip to the van, I lingered on the edge of that star-filled lake stretched before me, listening to the nighttime serenade from insects I probably couldn't name. It wasn't the sound, but the stillness that stays with me, a stillness that seemed to neutralize the many mishaps that had compounded throughout the day. I took in one last gallon-sized breath before returning to the tent, where, upon entering, I saw my entire world snoozing safely together, a pile of legs, arms, and stuffed animals all woven together. I reached for my sleeping bag, only to find that the puppy had since commandeered it as his own. "Well played, dog. Well played." Finding a spot on the tent's damp floor, I reached for a towel, closed my eyes, and took my place in the pile. It was the best of times, indeed.
BJ Hollers is a writer and assistant professor at University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, the first Saudi-backed LIV professional golf tournament just wrapped up in London. We'll talk about the concept of sports washing and how this alternative to the PGA Tour is shaking up the sport. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. The PGA Tour suspended golfers who elected to also participate in a new, highly lucrative tour that just finished its first event in London. The LIV Tour is funded by the Saudi Arabian government's Public Investment Fund. Its supporters, including American participant Phil Mickelson, have drawn criticism for aligning themselves with them and profiting. What's going on in the golf world right now as a result? How are players dealing with the issues it raises over being seen as endorsing Saudi Arabian leaders and questions of their obligation to already existing tours? Gary D'Amato has covered golf in Wisconsin for several decades, including for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, now for Wisconsin.golf. Gary, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Ron. I appreciate it.
Now, I think this is one of those stories, Gary, where there are some people in the golf world who are super focused on it, and some people are just kind of hearing about it, maybe even for the first time. Give us the nuts and bolts. What is this Saudi Arabian-backed tour? Why is it controversial in the golf world?
Well, yeah, that's a big loaded question. It's a new tour that is funded by Saudi Arabia's Public Investment Fund, which is, you know, talking billions of dollars. The PGA Tour can't compete with that kind of money. So what's happening is that this new LIV Tour, of which Greg Norman is the sort of the mouthpiece and sort of the head of the whole tour, they are siphoning off players from the PGA Tour by offering them huge money, just appearance fees. For instance, Phil Mickelson is getting a reported $200 million for this tour, and Dustin Johnson, $150 million. And even and journeymen and players who are in their 40s and really haven't won tournaments in $5 and $10 million to jump to this tour. And then it's offering huge purses on top, $25 million for this past weekend's purse, with $4.75 million winner Charles Schwartzel from South Africa. So we are talking enormous amounts of money. The players, it's 54 hole tournaments instead of 72 PGA Tour. There are no cuts, so you are guaranteed to make money. Last place this past week paid $120,000 to a guy who shot three scores around 80. There's no real competition, and it's just sort of a legend of the PGA Tour between players who are
going to this tour and players who are supporting the PGA Tour.
Now, there's a couple points of controversy here. Some golfers have criticized it because it's backed by the Saudi Arabian government. Looking back at the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, other human rights abuses. Is this something that you're hearing people in the golf world talk about, the moral hazard of joining this tour?
So many of the players who are not going over to Saudi Arabia and to the LIV Tour are talking about that subject. And the players who are going are sort of glossing over it, saying, you know, we're here to grow the game of golf. We're, you know, this is Saudi Arabia trying to take steps to improve itself. But a lot of people are seeing right through those and saying they're just going for the money, which is kind of what I happen to believe. Being thrown enormous amounts of money at these guys. And what I say, Rob, is that if Saudi Arabia really wanted to show how progressive it is, it would fund a women's tour and throw that money at women. But of course, I don't think that's going to happen.
Now, this isn't new in the sports world. There have been questions about, you know, American leagues trying to not offend China so that Chinese consumers will still buy, you know, say NBA products or things like that. Olympics, all sorts of politics getting in the way in those. Is this something you've seen in the golf world before, though?
A little bit, because the PGA Tour does do business in China. They are trying to grow the game in China, and we all know that China's is guilty of many human rights abuses and has a pretty poor record in that department too. So, and the NBA is, of course, is all in on China. So this has happened, but not to this extent, and not so visible with the top players in the world going over and playing on this tour.
Talking to Gary D'Amato, longtime golf reporter in Wisconsin, now with Wisconsin.golf, talking about this LIV golf tour sponsored with big money by a Saudi Arabian investment fund. Now, Gary, that the Saudi Arabian human rights angle is part of the story here. There's also, I think, a notion, if I'm reading this right, from the PGA of, like, you know, dance with the one that brung you. The PGA Tour is where a lot of these golfers got on the map. That's where they rose through the ranks, and now they're jumping ship for big money. Can you talk about these issues of I guess, loyalty to the organization?
Yeah, absolutely. The PGA Tour is a membership organization that's been around for nearly a century now. And, you know, what the PGA Tour can't offer, the type of money that the Saudis offers, but what they can offer is true competition, for one thing. I think people through right now that the LIV Tour is not really competition. I mean, if you're having a bad day on the golf course and you know that you're still going to make money no matter what you do, I don't grind as hard as you do maybe on the PGA Tour, where it's a true meritocracy and you're paid for your performance. Also, what the PGA Tour can offer is history and legacy. And that's something, obviously, that the LIV Tour has absolutely nothing or none of. Credibility, stability, the PGA Tour has all those things going for it, and right now the LIV Tour does not.
And a recent piece, you heard from Wisconsin golfers, Steve Stricker in particular. What did you hear from him and his thoughts about this whole dust-up?
Yeah, I asked him if he were, you know, Steve's 55 and obviously past his prime, although he still, you know, plays very well. But he's not going to be a winner on the PGA Tour anymore. And I asked him if he was 30 years old and in the top 10 in the world as he was back then, what would he do if the Saudis had him and offered him, you know, 20, 30, 40 million to jump ship? And he said, you know, really, I can say right now I wouldn't go. But he said, I'm saying that now at age 50. What would I do, you know, then? It's impossible to say. He said it would have been a decision. And I will say, Rob, that, you know, it's easy for people to criticize the golf for going over and saying, you know, they're supporting their Saudi effort to sport wash its record and a terrible regime and all these things. But up in their shoes and someone throws, you know, 50 million at you, what would you do? I think it's a harder decision than people would think it is. Talking just about morals and ethics, and would you do it on those grounds? Well, things change. A lot of money is thrown your way, as we've seen.
Now, is there anything that says if I were a high-class golfer, which I am not, but if I were, is there anything to say I couldn't do both? I couldn't keep doing the PGA Tour and take the extra cash to do this Saudi Arabian tournament?
that because the PGA Tour clearly sees the LIV Tour as a huge threat, siphoning players to play in events that are opposite PGA Tour events. So they are losing players to this league. And so the PGA Tour has set its down its foot and said, anyone who not giving you releases to go play in these tournaments, and if you do, you are suspended. So all the players who have gone over there have been suspended. Some of them have resigned their PGA Tour membership. And people say, why would they resign? Well, it's so, this is headed toward litigation. It's going to wind up in the courts at some point. And the players who don't want to get, you know, will probably get dragged into this in court. So they're resigning so they don't have to worry about, you know, being brought into court and being sued.
Gary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Gary D'Amato. He covers golf for Wisconsin.golf. He was with us today to talk about how the PGA and the golf world are responding to a new Saudi-backed professional tour that's raising issues of loyalty and morality for golfers. If you have been following this, love to hear from you. If you're in the golf community here in the state, do you have a thought on whether this is good or bad for the game? If you want to see golfers take this Saudi offer up, let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Senate negotiators from both parties say they've reached a tentative deal related to guns, with some limited regulation changes, plus funding for mental health crisis treatment and school security. We'll find out what's on the table, and you can join in with your thoughts. And we'll head to the movies. The new Top Gun movie did well at the box office after a couple of big superhero movies did, too. Are people ready to head back to the theaters in large numbers? Are you? We'll get the latest. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then perceptions about religion and politics in the U.S. don't always match reality. We'll talk to the author of a new book about church attendance, abortion, and we'll bust some myths along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the House Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol held its second day of public hearings. We'll recap the latest testimony from members of the Trump campaign and the Trump administration, who said they told then-President Trump that his voter fraud claims were baseless. First, religion plays a big role in the United States. That's no secret. And religious beliefs can influence what we think about politics. One religious group might care a lot about specific political issues, or people of one faith might be more likely to support one party over another. But our next guest says there's a lot we get wrong about the way religion and politics come together, and we see those myths in the media and in public conversations. He says if you look at the data, there's a more complicated picture of how religion and politics relate than you might think. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're religious or not, is there something you think people get wrong about your faith or lack of same when it comes to politics? Is there anything you think people who think differently than you get wrong about those beliefs? Is there a conventional wisdom about religious politics you want to check with our guest on whether it's the real deal? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ryan Burge is an assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. He's also a pastor at the First Baptist Church in Mount Vernon, Illinois. His new book is called 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, even before you started this book, you've taken on this role as a go-to person to check data and beliefs about religion and politics. Why? How did you fall into that role?
You know what? If you post 1,500 graphs a year for 3 years in a row about religion and politics, I call it the bat signal. I'll be like out with my kids somewhere, and I'll see a notification on my phone. Someone tagged me, "Hey, Ryan Burge, can you check on this for me?" And I'm like, "I'm not on my computer right now. I can't look at the data." But people constantly try to bring me in on the scene to try to fact check other people's statements about religion and politics that they just don't think look right.
Before we dig into some specific myths, why is it important to get this right, to have a better understanding of religion and faith and politics?
Yeah, I just think, you know, that facts are the building blocks, are the foundation pieces of the way we understand the world. And if we, you know, can't agree on the facts, then we can't even agree on, you know, how to approach policy if we don't know what the problem is. If we don't know how big this religious group is or what that religious group believes or how they vote, how can we really interact with them in a social way? And the problem is, you know, if you look at the data, we asked Republicans to describe Democrats and Democrats to describe Republicans. They have a completely distorted view of each other. So we always kind of like other the other people out there in society, and we create a misconception in our mind, and we don't like that misconception very much, when the reality is they're a lot more similar to you than you think they are. And once we get to that point, I think we have a lot more, you know, fruitful conversations and good dialogue if we really see each other for how we really are, not how we misperceive each other.
Now, you picked 20 myths here. How did you fall into picking the ones that you chose? What led you to use these as your examples of what we get wrong?
A lot of it was just, I may have a little note on my phone of like stuff I see on Twitter all the time. And I'm like, I need to go into that more. Like that's, I can't do 280 characters and get that and explain that whole thing. But the other thing that was going on in my mind was I wanted to make sure that I busted some myths that made conservatives kind of nervous, but also some myths that made liberals kind of nervous at the same time. Because, you know, being a mythbuster isn't just about making one party or one, you know, ideological viewpoint feel good. It's about trying to describe the world in an objective way, which means that sometimes the left's not going to be happy and sometimes the right's not going to be happy. And my job is to make everyone feel a little bit upset, but hopefully a lot more enlightened when they see what the data says.
We're talking to Ryan Burge about his new book, 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If there's something that you know is wrong about how people talk about religion and politics, or if you're wondering, you want a little fact check, Ryan might be able to hook you up. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's get into some of your myths now, Ryan. One, the idea that young people become less religious during or after college. There's a de-religiousizing, if I can make up that word, experience that comes along with college. What does the data show?
Yeah, so there's this, that myth comes, I think largely there was a book or a movie came out called God's Not Dead about 10 years ago, where this evangelical student goes to a public university where there's an atheist philosophy professor. And the entire movie is kind of a conflict between him, the evangelical, and the atheist philosophy professor. The philosophy professor wants the kid to sign a pledge that says God's not dead. And if he doesn't sign it, he can't pass the class. So there's this constant like trope out there. If you send your kids away to college, they're going to leave, you know, perfect evangelicals or perfect, you know, Catholics, and they're going to come back Marxist, you know, quoting Nietzsche atheists. If you look at the data, kids who go to college are actually more likely to go to church than kids who don't go to college. And they're more likely to declare a religious affiliation than kids who don't go to college. If we look at young people, like 18 to 22 year old people today, about 40% of them who are going to college say they're atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. It's closer to 50% of 18 to 22 year olds who are not going to college right now. And there's actually other data that says that, you know, the more you expose kids to other religions actually strengthens their own personal faith that much more. So we really shouldn't be afraid of exposing people to other faiths. It actually makes them stronger.
Here's another one, non-denominational Christian churches. And I got to admit to this, as someone who, you know, talks about religion on the air sometimes and just thinks about it, reads about it, I think, okay, you divide up Christianity by, you know, Orthodox, Catholic, Protestant, you've got these well-defined denominations. Everybody's going to end up falling into a category. Well, not so much anymore. What's up with the rise of non-denominational Christianity?
Yeah, I think this is actually a great topic to talk about right now because the Southern Baptist Convention is meeting this week, and every reporter that does religion in America seems to be in Anaheim, California, covering that group, which is an important group. 13.5 million Americans are Southern Baptists. They're the largest Protestant denomination in America, but the share of Americans who are non-denominational Protestant is probably closer to 30 million Americans. So there's twice as many non-denominational Protestant Christians in America as there are Southern Baptists. In the 1970s, only 3% of Protestants said they're non-denominational, and now it's 25% of Protestants say they're non-denominational. And over the last 10 years, the only religious tradition, Christian tradition, that grew in America, it wasn't Baptists or Methodists or Lutherans or Presbyterians, it was non-denominational Protestant Christianity. And there's a future, I think, where there are more non-denominational Protestants than denominational Protestants in the United States.
This means something. What does it mean?
Oh, I think it's a radical rethinking of American religion. Because if you think about what religion is, most denominations are very top-down, right? Whether the Catholic Church is obviously top-down, but also the Episcopalians, the United Methodists, and even at some level, the Southern Baptists do have a national structure that they kind of organize underneath. Non-denominational churches are, you know, they're bottom-up, they're grassroots, and many of them were started by pastors who were not pastors at all. They were insurance salesmen or real estate agents or worked in a construction company or something like that. Start a Bible study in their basement. All of a sudden, 2 or 3 years later, they got 300 or 400 people in their church, and they really have no theological training at all. So, you know, we're really losing gatekeepers in American society. You know, there's no credentialing for these kind of groups, and so they all kind of live independently of one another, and we really can't constrain them in any way. Like denominations used to kick pastors out who were, you know, saying unorthodox or heretical things. There's nobody to come in and kick these pastors out. If their church is growing, that's really all that matters to them.
Abortion has been in the news a lot lately with the leaked Supreme Court draft document, the final deal expected to come out any time now. Really, that's one of the myths you looked at, the idea that most Americans are really at one end of the abortion debate or the other.
Yeah, I think that's the one that it's so difficult to try to poll about abortion because people have contradictory opinions about abortion. There was this great study by Tricia Bruce at Notre Dame where she actually did long-form interviews with about 150 people about the topic of abortion. And she would ask them the same question in a different way at different points in the interview. And she would point out when they contradicted themselves, and they would kind of smile and laugh a little bit at themselves, go, I know I'm contradicting myself. Because people don't, most Americans don't have a clear black and white view on abortion. Even people who are very pro-choice, a lot of them have some trepidation, you know, in certain circumstances, like the government paying for it or late-term abortion or things like that. And even people who are pro-life, you know, they're not exactly against abortion in the case of, let's say, rape or incest or severe fetal defect or life of the mother, let's say. Most Americans are sort of in that pragmatic middle where they don't really find abortion palatable, but they understand that some people want to have an abortion and they don't want to restrict that right. So really what's going on with Roe versus Wade is we're trying to put people into far left or far right camps. And the majority of Americans are kind of in that mushy middle, and they really don't want, you know, abortion to be completely legal in every circumstance. They also don't want it to be completely illegal either.
We're talking to Ryan Burge, assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University, with us today to talk about his new book, 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about religious affiliations in the U.S., how it fits into the political landscape? Do you have ideas or theories of your own? Is your community, you think, mischaracterized by other people, by the media, by politicians? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Ryan Burge about his new book. It's called 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe even your own experiences at 800-642-1234. Have you seen your faith community, whatever it might be, changing over the years, getting more political, less political, the people you talk to? Have you switched your faith community, the one you go to observances with, to church, to synagogue, you name it, because of politics for some reason? Or do you have a question just about some of the myths our guest is talking about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Ryan, I've talked to you in the past about the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, people who say, yeah, I'm not really affiliated with any particular religion or atheism or agnosticism for that matter. And you write in this new book, there's a lot of misconceptions about them. And one of them is the idea that they are, you know, the numbers have been going up, that's true, but the idea that they're people who abandoned church for the most part or left a religious tradition. What do you see actually happening?
Yeah, that's something that a lot of evangelicals ask me about, is why are people leaving church? And if you actually look at the data, more and more people are not leaving church. They were never raised with church in the first place. You know, for instance, we ask people in surveys, what was your religion growing up and what is your current religion? And, you know, the share of Americans who are raised without religion is going up every year. It's now over 20%. And what we're seeing is the share of people who are raised without religion, who stay with no religion as adults. It used to be 1/3 of them stayed nuns as adults, and now it's 2/3 of them stay nuns as adults. So we're seeing more and more people entering adulthood. About 1 in 3 Americans now enters adulthood without a religious affiliation, when it used to be less than 10% back in the 1970s. So it's not like people are leaving church, you know, at 25, 30, 35 years old. They never had a religious tradition to begin with, and they never really pick one up as they move into adulthood.
Another nun-related myth, again, N-O-N-E, is that the rise of unaffiliated people, religiously unaffiliated, means the country as a whole is generally getting less religious. What do you see actually happening?
I see religious polarization happening. So, you know, the people who are left now are the real true believers. And that's not just evangelicals. That's also conservative Catholics and, let's say, Orthodox Jews and Latter-day Saints and people like that. What we're really seeing in America is sort of the hollowing out of moderate religion in America. We used to have a tradition in America called the mainline tradition, which was about 30% of America in 1975 that are Episcopalians, United Methodist Church, United Church of Christ, folks like that. They were 30% of America in 1975. Now they're less than 10% of America today. Those used to be kind of the bridging churches where people from both political parties kind of, you know, sat side by side in the pews. And a lot of those people became nuns over time, or their kids are becoming, they were being raised with no religion. So now we're having a bunch of very, very religious people on the right side of the political spectrum and a whole bunch of nuns on the left side of the political spectrum. And really no one in that moderate middle that used to build bridges between the left and the right in America. It's just people on the far sides of the religious and political spectrum in America kind of shooting arrows at each other and yelling at each other and making and thinking the worst about the other side.
An interesting question that reminds me of, and this can generate debate, I think, in the evangelical world. A decent number of people that you and others have surveyed will identify themselves as evangelicals who go to church never or almost never. And then some of the evangelical people you talk to are like, well, whoa, hang on. You got to show up. How do you square that difference?
Yeah, I wrote a piece for the New York Times that really got a lot of, I think I'm going to, on my headstone, it's going to say Ryan Burns, the guy who talked about never attending evangelicals. but they're a growing force in American evangelicals. So about 40% of people who say they're evangelical on surveys say they attend church never or seldom, which means less than once a year they're going to church. 40% of evangelicals now attend church less than once a year. It was 27% in 2008. So what we're seeing is the word evangelical, which we've always thought is sort of a theological religious term, now in the minds of the average person seems to have sort of jumped the fence from that theological grounding, and now has a cultural and political implication. And I think for a lot of Americans, they're seeing the word evangelical mean I'm very conservative, you know, politically, but I'm also aligned with Donald Trump, let's say. And we're seeing even non-evangelical groups. Let's say, you know, there's a rising number of born again or evangelical Catholics now. About 1 in 5 Catholics say they're born again. So we're seeing a rise of these conservative Catholics calling themselves evangelical because they like the cultural cachet of what that word means when they really don't think a lot about evangelical, you know, theology or views of Jesus or anything like that.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Lou is with us in northern Wisconsin. Lou, hello.
Hi, guys. I just want to say that religion is a man-made construct. What we are more is spiritual. You know, we're in touch more with the spirit side instead of the traditions and so forth.
And if I may ask you, Lou, if I were to survey you, how would you list yourself on a survey asking, you know, what religion do you identify with?
Right now I am none. I was an Episcopalian, not quite from cradle, but for quite many years. And I even discerned to go to seminary. But, you know, the greater power led me on a different path. And I understand why now. I have a better understanding because I have a very good relationship with that greater power. And it's a very spiritual life now instead of religion. Like I say that, you know, it involves so many things that are directed by man, not by the spiritual realm.
Lou, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Ryan, an interesting example of someone who puts herself in that nun category. I imagine this has got to be a category that's kind of hard to study, though, in some ways, because some people might have Lou's exact story. Some might have very different stories.
Yeah, what's interesting about Lou is she's actually telling a story I think is actually running rampant across American society, which is a move toward anti-institutionalism, right? She even said it, like, I'm spiritual, but I don't like the institutions around religion. if you ask people on surveys, about 45% of Americans say they're very spiritual, but only 27% of people say they're very religious. Because I think for a lot of people, religion has a institutional component to a man-made component to it. They're still very, very religious. By the way, even amongst people who never attend church, they're more likely to say that God exists without any doubt than they are to say that God does not exist at all. So Americans have a stubborn belief in a higher power, even though they've sort of left institutional religion in droves over the last 20 or 30 or 40 years. That doesn't mean their belief in God has gone anywhere. I think in actually some ways it's actually become stronger because it's become more about spirituality than religiosity, let's say.
Thanks for that call, Lou. We're talking to Ryan Burge. His new book is called 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. One more I wanted to get into, a very direct political tie. In the media, we often look at a candidate, say a presidential candidate's behavior and their expression of religion. Do they go to church? Do they quote scripture? Things like that. And assume that that is going to have an appeal to voters of a similar faith. Not so much.
Yeah. So, I mean, the media's got to write stories for the presidential candidates for months leading up to the election. And, you know, religion's always a topic they want to kind of dig into. And when Joe Biden won the nomination for the Democrats, the whole narrative kind of switched to, I bet Joe Biden can win back some white Catholics that Hillary Clinton lost in 2016. But if you look at the data, Joe Biden actually did worse with white Catholics at every attendance level in 2020 compared to how Hillary Clinton did with that same group in 2016. So, you know, the personal religiosity of a candidate, I think, matters very, very little. The most important thing when it comes to voting is the R behind their name or the D behind their name. That's really what guides almost all voting behavior in 2020 or 2022, where partisanship rules everything. And I think religion, I don't want to talk myself out of a job here, but religion has a subordinate role to partisanship in modern American life.
Another question that with the Southern Baptist Convention you mentioned going on now that you looked at is, okay, evangelical traditions in particular, some Catholic, and of course the Catholic Church says no women preaching, no women in these official roles, running church services. What happens when you ask the members of those congregations what they think?
Yeah, people are blown away by this. But if you ask people, are you okay with a woman, given that she's qualified, you know, preaching behind the pulpit on a Sunday morning, you ask evangelicals that, and over 70% of them say they're fine with that. And it's over 70% of Roman Catholics are fine with a woman priest. So, you know, in the pews, there's not nearly this resistance to female pastors as there are, you know, from the hierarchical structures that exist in both those institutions, the Southern Baptist Convention and the Roman Catholic Church. Americans take very pragmatic views of things like that. And I've done all kinds of work on that data, trying to make that support drop, you know, looking, let's say, just at older men or, you know, people who believe the Bible is literally true. And it's almost impossible to find a group where support for women preaching goes below 60%. So there's a lot of widespread support in America, not just, you know, in American society generally, but even in conservative religious circles to allow women to have full access to all leadership roles that men have access to.
In our last couple minutes, what are some questions about religion and politics that you're still trying to figure out how to answer? Data can work for a lot of things. Sometimes it's hard to tease things out.
Oh, man. I mean, where do we start, Rob? There's so many things that keep me up at night. One is, you know, why the mainline collapsed. I brought them up earlier, right? The United Methodist Church, the Episcopal Church, they used to be these powerhouses in American society, American politics, and now they're really sort of marginalized in every single way. If people were sick of evangelicalism and the conservatism that goes along with that, why did they not leave and join a mainline church, which are much more moderate? They're LGBT affirming. They have female pastors. They're kind of progressive on social policy. A lot of evangelicals who are liberal should have left and gone to those churches, yet they left religion behind entirely. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. That's one. Why did the mainline decline? The other one is, why are people leaving church? I mean, that's one that is like a $1 million question. The problem with that is it's really, really hard to answer those questions. So if I say, for instance, the average Southern Baptist is 20% more conservative today than the average Southern Baptist 30 years ago, the problem is those aren't the same people today as they were 30 years ago. That group's gotten smaller over the last 30 years. So is it the moderates and the liberals that left, or just the people there became more conservative over time? That's a really hard data problem to solve because you have to use what's called panel data, which is where you ask the same people the same questions over a long period of time. It's really, really expensive. It's really, really cumbersome. And by the time you get that data back, I'll be in my 60s and won't want to write about it anymore. So that's just two of many, many that I think about at night, things I can't answer right now.
Ryan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Ryan Burge, assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University and a pastor in the American Baptist Church, with us today to talk about his new book. It's called 20 Myths About Religion and Politics in America. Coming up after the news, we'll look at the latest testimony this morning from the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection and the events leading up to it. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.